right, welcome back. We are Outside the Box. This is our clinical podcast driving performance here in the city of Sugar Land. You got your host, Kevin. Today with me, we got Sean Lackey. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Today, we're talking about breathing problems. We all like breathing. I'm a big fan. I try to do it every day. I like it so much. And we're going to talk about how we help people having trouble breathing, right? Specifically asthma today.
Excellent.
Before we do, let's meet Sean. Sean, tell us about you and some of your background.
Hey, name is Sean Lackey. Got involved and started all this at HFD. If you've heard a story about some rookie that keeps breaking a bone while on probation, that's me. I'm that guy. Turns out ambulances and roller skating is really dangerous. So watch out for that. And there's also no protocol for it, too. So that's not my fault.
Excellent. How long have you been here at Sugar Land?
I've been at Sugar Land now about a year and a half.
All right. And how much of that time were you injured?
6 months. Six. So I finally hit 1 year, thankfully.
We got to spend some good time together while your wing was bandaged up. Look,
yes,
so well, welcome back to the field. Welcome to the show. Thanks for taking some time to join us today.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So we're going to talk about asthma. Asthma exacerbation is bad news, can cause people a lot of trouble. Will you give us a quick rundown on an asthma presentation? What's happening in asthma? What do we see? And what are we worried about?
Sure. So with asthma, what it basically boils down to is an overactive immune response. This is not to say that it's anaphylaxis. That's a different sort of subgenre of the same problem. And what it does is we have a couple of things. We have irritation of the lining. We have a narrowing of the bronchioles. And effectively, it is hard for them to exhale, but not necessarily too difficult for them to inhale.
Mm-hmm.
The presentation that we're going to be seeing is, well, typically if we see them, they have a history of it. They're going to know what you're talking about. If they say you say the word albuterol, they know what you're saying. And they will also have the classic wheezing. And if you don't want to listen to their lung sound, sometimes you can just hear it. You can also use capnography, and that'll completely tell you the entire story. Everything you need to know is going to be right there on the screen.
I love capnography. I love it. All right. I kind of liken it to a flapper valve that us firefighters might understand. That
sure.
Water flows real nicely one way, but then has a lot of trouble coming back the other way is the purpose of the valve.
Okay.
To prevent that backflow. And we're seeing the same kind of things in the lungs. Like you were saying, I can inhale pretty decent, adequately.
Right.
I mean, not fabulous, but then the air coming out's the trouble. Right.
And
the concept is auto-peeping is what we call it.
Yeah.
That, you know, peep is keeping the lungs inflated with a certain pressure mechanically. But we're doing the same kind of thing that I inhale and then inhale some more and then I inhale some more and we trap all that air in. So we are pathologically increasing peep, giving us a whole lot of trouble. So, right, gives us a real challenge when these people get this exacerbation. And I like how you talk about, you mentioned anaphylaxis in here, because it too is an immune system problem.
Right.
And just in a conversation this morning, we talked about asthma comparing to allergic reactions, that it's kind of a dormant condition until something triggers it, just like allergies.
Right.
Not even anaphylaxis, but I'm pretty good with my allergies. But then when the pollen count comes and we get just everything caked in pollen and it's just that disgusting time of year, I'm stuffy and I'm drainy and I need to take some medication. Other times of the year, my allergies are fine. They're there. Asthma's there. Something kind of triggers this and sets it off.
So it's fine until something goes wrong and then it goes nuts.
Yeah, and then we can have some real serious trouble with
it. It's basically my ex-girlfriend, so I'm
talking about it. Oh, goodness. Oh, Sean, you troublemaker. Okay, so an overactive immune system, we get bronchoconstriction, we even get mucus production, we get all this goop in there, don't like it, which is, again, is immune function, and the word I like to use is deranged. This is a deranged immune response. It just doesn't make sense why the body would do this. These are all protective things it's doing with swelling and mucus production, but it's not helpful. Actually, it's very unhelpful. In fact, it's dangerous. So the same thing with anaphylaxis is the immune system thinking it's doing something right. But again, I love the word deranged because it just sounds cool, right? It's a deranged response. We got to get it back on track. So give us a quick rundown of some of our medication options for treating asthma. What's our standing guidance on treating asthma?
All right. So this all the way from basic, we're still using the same things initially. we're going to be giving 2.5 of albuterol. And what that too is, what that is a beta 2 agonist.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, you know, what the layman would call the fight or flight or whatever, we're activating the sympathetic nervous system, beta 2. And that's going to be the bronchodilator that we learned about when we were just basics. And then, and that's going to hopefully expand the lungs, has a side effect of increasing the heart rate again, because it's non-selective. It just does its thing. Which one way to know, like, okay, is the medication even working? Well, if they themselves are not improving, but you're seeing an increase in heart rate, that could be a sense of the side effect, at least. That's still going on.
And these are the people that we're going to see them getting jittery.
Right.
Right? Because remember, this is a sympathetic nervous system response. So we're going to start getting some of the shaking, the jittery. I'm feeling antsy. I mean, they're already nearly suffocating as it is, so that would make anybody antsy. But then we went and put a stimulant on top of it.
So that would be sting.
Right.
Now, the other thing is that the body works in balance with other things. This is the parasympathetic nervous system, a.k.a. the brakes. And we're going to give another medication called ipratropium, Atrovent. And this is just a one-time 0.5 milligrams. And what that does is it basically turns off the brakes or inhibits them. So you're going to get this great effect. You're stopping the brakes and you're helping put a little bit of weight on the accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to, again, hopefully keep those lungs open so that we can keep breathing.
Yeah, and what I like with Atrovent, right, it's an anticholinergic.
Yes, sir.
And we don't typically think of it, and I've been looking for the literature, I can't find it. We get organophosphate poisoning, right? We got our big, like, sludgeum acronyms.
Right.
Which really, the toxicity in organophosphates is, like, every bit of moisture is going to come out of you. Your nose, your eyes, your mouth, other places, right? And we give a whole lot of atropine to dry that up because we want to get that parasympathetic nervous system chilled out. Because that's what the organophosphates are doing, is they dial up the parasympathetic nervous system that produce all of these secretions.
Right, right.
We're doing it on a much smaller scale in the lungs now in asthma, that the lungs are producing all this mucus. The parasympathetic system has an involvement in that. So we take this medication and, like you were saying, we kind of like chill out that system and let the sympathetic nervous system take over and do its thing. Like, hey, chill out. I'm trying to find the literature of where Atrovent has a place in organophosphate poisoning in
right.
conjunction with atropine. We're like, why not? Like, if we're giving 10, 12, 15 milligrams of atropine, which, I mean, we've called the whole freaking county if we need that much.
Right.
For crying
right.
out loud.
An ambulance does not have enough atropine
no,
on board to
absolutely not. Where does this place with Atrovent? So there's some fun for you if you want to look for a new topic to discuss, is the role of Atrovent as an anticholinergic in organophosphate
right.
poisoning. I can't find the literature. I haven't
looked at that. That's interesting.
Right. So it'd be an interesting. Okay. So we get back to this. Right. You said it. So it's a one-time deal.
Right.
Or Atrovent.
Once. Albuterol, they're very candid to say, hey, if it doesn't work, just go and hit him again with it. Mm-hmm. Atrovent. Every single piece of literature, every textbook I've studied, they say, no, that's it. You give it once and let it alone. Is it just because it's so profound and so strong? Or
I think it's because of the mechanism. We want the parasympathetic system, nervous system to calm down and chill out. We don't want it to go away.
Okay.
Right?
Fair enough. Right.
So I think that's what we're going for, is we just want to kind of temper that response and not eliminate. There's a whole lot of other functions that are coming out of the parasympathetic nervous system that we still need to happen.
Right.
That's how we have our balance. So we don't want to eliminate. We just want to.
Excellent. Excellent.
So, but you're right. In the albuterol is far shorter lasting effect too. So.
Excellent.
Yeah. What else?
So on top of that, well, and also this is nebulized. You're giving it with oxygen. Nebulizers max out at 10 liters per minute, O2. In the intermediate, if you're fortunate to have that, you would be giving... you have a couple options here. Terbutaline, 0.25 intramuscular, and Epi 1:1, again, intramuscular as well. And when I explained it, actually, the rookie I'm working with, Shane, very curious, wonderful guy, and I said, well, we're effectively attacking the sympathetic nervous system from the lungs, and then now we're also attacking it on the other side with the rest of the system. We're trying to get that bronchodilation, that necessarily vasoconstriction, but, you know, this is a serious issue, and we are aggressively attacking it. And the terbutaline is going to help us slow down the you know, the smooth muscle relaxation. That's also going to help everything out even more. And then we're on top of that, we're going to go with dexamethasone as well, IM or IV. And as I understand, you were mentioning that timing is important with that more than we would have thought.
Yes, this is correct, that we don't see the effects of the steroid, that this might be well past 60 minutes after administration that we see the real benefit. And again, like we talked about, this is an immune response. We want to chill out the immune system, stop it. This is really our only addressing the actual cause of the problem, right? Otherwise, it's purely symptom management. Bronchodilation, drying up the mucus, oxygenating. These are symptoms that come out of this overactive, deranged immune response. So we can continue to chase symptoms, but we have to at some point address the cause so the symptoms stop recurring. And that's where the steroid comes in here. That's where dexamethasone comes in. And the earlier we give it, the more we stop the problem from recurring. Otherwise, we're giving albuterol, we're giving Atrovent, even we give the terbutaline that we'll come back and talk about, and we get them to the hospital, and the asthma attack's still happening. Like, it's in the background. We may have opened up the lungs a little bit. The asthma attack's still happening. The immune irritation is still happening.
Right.
So it's just standard course of treatment. They're going to get steroids at the hospital. But if we move that up by 60, 45, 30 minutes, and we can give it early on the patient contact, we can shave days off of their hospital stay because we've started the definitive end treatment early on. So we're symptom managing. We're addressing their cause of the problem. And it legitimately can. We can shave hospital stay time off, which turns out to, like, breathing better and feeling better, period, faster. Sick people are at hospitals.
Right.
Right? So we get out of the incubator of illness and unwell, get you out of that and back home. And the financial burden of that, like, staying in a hospital
is not cheap.
Expensive, right? There's a good chance that our dose of steroid is not going to be the cure. That there's a good chance this person may need further steroid therapy at the hospital for their symptom management also. But again, it's the time to the intervention that turns out to be crucial. So we want that whole package intervention of symptom management and cause addressing interventions right up front to get that benefit on the back end, even though we don't see it. Right. And that's one of the challenges, I think, in what we do, period, is that we often don't see past that. Or we might come back in a couple of hours with the next patient and see things now, but we still don't see the couple hours in between. We don't see the intermediary interventions. We don't know what's ours and what's not. We just know this person's better or not.
They're going to be on a mag drip at that point.
So, yeah. But what I'm telling you is this Dex administered early on makes a difference down the road.
Gotcha. 100%. So that's the actual solution to the problem.
Yes. Okay. That's a much more directed at the problem intervention.
Okay.
Yeah.
I get you.
So let's come back to TERB, though. Terbutaline. It seems like a small dose. But it is a small dose, right? 0.25.
It seems so insignificant.
It does. And what's the function of terbutaline again? Remind us what that does.
It is a smooth muscle relaxer.
Right? It is. And it's actually a much more selective bronchodilator, beta 2 agonist than the albuterol is, because you had mentioned that we have a non-selective beta agonist, albuterol, which will give us the bronchodilation, but will then also give us an increased heart stimulation, so some increased heart rate, some increased contractility, all those things is a byproduct, and we're willing to tolerate that for what we get in the lungs. It's what you get.
Right.
There are some other medications that are beta 2 selective nebulized, but boy, they're expensive. Albuterol is just so readily accepted as a practice, it's widely available, it's affordable. So if albuterol were causing massive problems with its non-selective beta agonism, then maybe we'd adjust. But that's why this alternative never really grabbed a lot of ground.
Right, there's no need for it. It does the job it needs. And it sounds like the vast majority of people who have asthma, they're just fine with their albuterol.
They are just fine with it, yeah. Especially when they go to the pharmacy. So the terbutaline is more selective on the beta 2 into the lungs. And we were talking about this a little bit before the show. Why don't you tell everybody where terbutaline started?
As I understand, like, it seems like all the really cool drugs, it was intended for something else. And then they said, hey, that's got some cool side effects. In this case, it was actually used for obstetrics, as I was saying, right? To sort of help time deliveries, right, and to slow down the uterus and to give people time to do whatever it is that they felt they needed to be done. And then they notice, well, hey, this is really helping the lungs out. And then here we are today.
Mm-hmm. The uterus is just a big hollow organ. Well, not big. Can be, when gravid, a big hollow organ lined with smooth muscle.
Right.
And that's how the uterus functions when it is time to go into labor. It's just squeezing this smooth muscle until this baby's shoved on out. That sounds so easy, right? Obstetrics assistant.
It sounds like such a non-traumatic
thing. Yeah, my wife would probably kill me hearing me talking about it. Right, but that was the goal. Is we can kind of slow down or stall labor, preterm labor, as medicine, not us. As medicine, we can kind of manage unanticipated or undesirable labor timing with terbutaline as a smooth muscle relaxer. But realize that the irritated muscles in the bronchial tree are smooth muscle.
Gotcha.
So phenomenal application that we bring it over. And you're right that it was a much more readily accepted practice in obstetrics. It still is, as I understand. And there is a smaller group that use it in respiratory. And I, like you were saying, that this is one of the first places that you've seen terbutaline in practice as a respiratory therapy.
100%. In fact, before I came here, I had never even seen it mentioned in a textbook.
Mm.
And never in my intermediate and certainly never in my paramedics. So
what did you use in lieu of terbutaline?
Magnesium.
Magnesium? Did you have anything before you would get to magnesium with it?
No.
Wow.
No.
Okay. I grew up on epi.
Okay.
I am epi. And it too, right here we have a broad parasympathetic nervous system agonist, right? Our alpha, beta receptors all across the board. So we'll get smooth muscle relaxing out of albuterol. I'm sorry, I'm talking about epinephrine now. Out of the epinephrine. And in fact, there's a treatment pathway where that is our standard practice, right? And we've already mentioned it, but that's how we treat allergies.
Right.
As we go with epi. And there's some good reason why epi is our choice in allergies versus terbutaline in asthma. And what are your thoughts there? If we had to compare epi to terbutaline and what we know about it, even what we've already said about terbutaline, how do you understand terbutaline being our first choice in asthma and making it a better choice?
So my understanding is terbutaline is going to target a lot more of the problem, whereas epinephrine is going to attack the entire system or whatnot. It's like the big clumsy hammer to something, whereas terbutaline might be, maybe it's the wrong way to put it, but more of the surgical, more of like, I need to push this button right now kind of thing.
I like that kind of analogy because it is. What side effects, we get the lungs in epi, what side effects come with epi?
Well, with epi, you get, the increased contractility, the increased pulse rate, and with that means increased oxygen demand. Which for somebody who's starving of oxygen because of the condition, this may not be exactly what we want to be doing at that moment.
Yeah, and what are we already giving them?
We're already giving them another beta 2 agonist as well.
So, right. Yeah, I mean, we're already making the heart tick faster.
Right, and we're already
giving
slowing
more,
down
make
the brakes.
Them tick faster. Oh goodness! So, terbutaline gives us a really good option to focus on the lungs, on the smooth muscle that's causing us the trouble. So, but epinephrine is still listed in the guideline. It is still a treatment option. And just like you were saying, that's kind of the approach we need to take when we're evaluating these, that terbutaline is a good first choice. We want you to think of that one first and have that ready to go because of those benefits. But epi is there because terbutaline may not always do the job.
Okay.
So epi remains. It's
so
in there.
Terbutaline is like basically you asking the lungs very nicely to knock it off. And then epi is the, when dad's putting his foot down. Is that correct?
I can go with that one. I can go.
You go with that one? Okay.
Yes. No, I'm done asking you now.
Okay.
You will. Yes. And the reason that epi is going to be an anaphylaxis first choice and not an asthma first choice, what other systemic problems do we have in anaphylaxis? That it's not just the lungs anymore.
Well, it's also going to be the throat itself locking up, and that's the real killer. And also it's going to be, and that's being caused by fluid leaking out of the circulatory system.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to inhibit that, is going to inhibit the histamine release. Also, of course, the Benadryl is going to do the real job on that aspect.
Yeah, that's our big one, is the circulatory involvement in anaphylaxis.
Mm.
We want some circulatory involvement from epi. That it's kind of like the economy of scale of it, that there's multiple effects of epi to hit multiple problems. Great. Instead of having a medication for the circulatory problem and then a medication for the respiratory problem. Mm. Like, here you go. Here's this one medication. Like, but wait, there's more, right?
Right. It's big the magic word on that, yeah.
That gives us our kind of our delineation between tubulin and epi, between these two. And realistically, in an allergic reaction, we get an anaphylaxis case. We get this wheezing because we're getting bronchoconstriction. I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you think tubulin would be effective in its beta-2 agonist role if in an allergic reaction? If we gave somebody's wheezing in an allergic reaction, we gave them tubulin, do you think that would help?
Well, I mean, the beta-2 part of it, sure. I mean, in terms of opening, is it going to be the 100% solution to the problem? No, we have other bigger, better tools for that. But to say that bronchodilation is not going to be a problem. And, you know, we can't have too much of that unless we have like barotrauma or whatever. But so, yes, but that's not going to be the solution to the answer.
Absolutely. We give them tributyline. Mm-hmm. We get some bronchodilation. We have the hypotension. How are we going to treat the hypotension anyway?
Give them epinephrine.
We're going to go to epi, right?
Right.
Let's skip this step. Go right to the epi. Give them the IM epi. And we go from there. Right, so good discussion on epi versus tubulin, where they fit in asthma anaphylaxis, and where our crossover is. We talked about dex. What routes are we given dex?
So the two ways we can give it is intramuscular, mm-hmm. and that's going to be nice in the people who unfortunately maybe have just the worst veins in the world or other conditions, diabetes, renal failure, where they have terrible veins. Or when we cannot get that IV, we can give them that way, and that's an option. But of anything you want done quickly, IV is going to be typically the better route. Mm-hmm. So IV and IM as well.
If you look in the guidelines, we have them listed as IM and also IV.
Right.
What I'm going to tell you the answer is I want them IM.
Okay.
Why do you think that might be?
Is it because we want a slower metabolization of the drug, or is it that or actually the other opposite, if we give it IV, the liver can sense it and then metabolize it maybe potentially too fast or faster than it would be given intramuscular? Is that the answer?
So you're on the right track with timing, but it's our timing of administration.
Oh, okay.
What did I say about how our timing of giving dex?
The sooner the better.
All these medications in respiratory are set, we can give them IV. But up to this point, the ones we've discussed, they're set to be IM, so they can go fast. That we can be giving multiple drugs at a time in each arm. We can be loading this patient up with the nebulizer, with the tubulin, with the dex, all in very close timing to each other, and not have to, I got to get a line set up. I'm looking over here for a vein. Do you see anything over there?
Right.
We have one of the days that all of us have been known to have that somehow we run out of IV catheters because we've tried that many times and this, like, the vein keeps disappearing, whatever it may
right.
be. Seconds add up to minutes, add up to hours and days. So if we can cut out a couple of minutes, get this medication in earlier, right, we're already addressing the problem earlier. Again, cutting time off the end of the stay, but we're addressing the problem earlier.
Right. And let me ask, as I understand it, we're sort of moving to where even the basics – they will not be administering, but they can certainly draw up the medication. Is that correct?
So one of the things that we made a practice out of is that the actual technical skill of an IM drug administration mm-hmm. is within a certain scope of practice.
Sure.
But the authorization to administer medications by that route fall under different credentialing levels.
Oh, okay.
So we have somebody who... it is within their scope of practice to give an IM medication, that we work on this kind of delegated authority positioning, that as the paramedic, you can turn to your basic partner, turn to your advanced partner, and it's, hey, this technical skill is in your scope. I'm lending you my authorization for this medication, and you can physically be the one that gives it. You still carry the responsibility as the authorizing person,
right?
As it's listed in the guidelines. But that's kind of the... a little bit of latitude that we have. Still expect the proper medication verification. You and I are going to look at this medication the same way. We're going to make sure the dosing is right. I don't know, our five rights and all this stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to package it, and you're going to ensure that the medication that's about to be administered is what we want, how we want, how much of it that we want, and it's going the right way. But because that's in that scope, we can do that. Now, a basic will know, we can look at it and see how to give IV medications. I have a lot of faith in our basics that had you handed them something, say, push this in the IV, they can. That's not in their scope of practice. So that becomes something that's now out of bounds. To hand your partner this medication and say, hey, go give that IV.
That's going to be a no.
That's out of bounds. We can do this with the intermediates, though, because at the advanced level, that is in their scope of practice, mm-hmm. that technical skill, and there's some authorized medications that they can give at their level of credentialing.
Right.
So there's some other ones that I might be able to delegate to an intermediate that, here's this medication. Again, we've done all our proper verification steps. You're the one administering this.
Great.
So that's where that comes in, is that the technical skill needs to be in the scope of practice of that certification level. And then we get the ability to lend out some of that authorization.
Right. They should already be allowed to draw up Epi 1-to-1 anyway for anaphylaxis as a basic. So might as well, yeah. What's the difference?
A great example is our pain management guideline, where we have a certain dose that we can go up to. Mm-hmm. And then we get on the phone with the captain and say, hey, I need some more fentanyl. And they have permission to authorize a larger dose and continue that pain management.
Right.
It's the permission end, right? So giving fentanyl is well within your scope of practice. Mm-hmm. IV, IM, whatever route you choose, that medication, it being narcotic, in your scope of practice. You get it on standing orders. You have standing authority to give it in the proper indicated situation.
Right.
To a certain limit. And then there's additional permissions that come with it.
Gotcha. Excellent. Excellent.
All right. So we got one more medication to talk about, and kind of is one of the fun ones that we started diving into mm-hmm. as we talked about this. Something you're familiar with in airway management.
Yes.
We have left.
The last one is magnesium sulfate.
Okay.
And as I understand, this has been utilized in hospitals for quite some time, but letting paramedics use it is somewhat new or new-ish. I've been asking around, and I said, hey, any of y'all got experience with giving mag? And I've been hearing glowing reviews from various paramedics that either work here or work in other places, and they say, oh, no, it works wonders. It's like you can almost say, hey, go back home or whatnot. No, we're not going to do that, obviously. But very positive reviews on the subject or whatnot. And what's interesting is how slow we're giving it. Mm-hmm. There's a smooth muscle relaxer. And
we want rapid change. We want this person to get better fast.
Right. I mean, we're used to. Yeah. But on this one, it's, it says here we're going to give 2 grams in 100 cc's over 20 minutes. And when I did the math for a 10-drop set, that's basically a drop every 4 seconds or whatnot, which is just not exciting.
Like watching paint dry.
Oh, absolutely. Right. But again, apparently it works great. I wanted to ask you, what can we expect with it? And especially what can we expect with it in combination with terbutaline?
Sure. I think this is it's a really good question. And there's a reason magnesium kind of moved further down the list and it's not up at the top.
Okay.
Mostly because of the rate that we're administering. You're absolutely right. We should be doing a lot of other things and hopefully we get some change first before magnesium comes in. Magnesium's going to work on the smooth muscle, just like everything else. We have some smooth muscle in the vasculature. It's going to cause the vessels to dilate a bit. We want that to be a slow and controlled dilation so the body can adjust and compensate and it be essentially a non-noticeable change, that the body will see this is the message we're getting to do. We'll adjust these things instead. If we go give 2 grams and shove it, we're going to get those changes in blood pressure. It's going to be really uncomfortable for this person. It's not necessarily going to be such a deadly thing in rapid administration. Could be. But we're going to get very flushed. We're going to get very itchy. We're going to get hot. We're going to start to feel like we're burning up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Very uncomfortable sensation for this patient. So
itchy, and you're talking about skin, or they're actually going to feel discomfort in their lungs?
Skin. Full body sensation. So we give it at this proper pace. We get it where we want it to be. It starts doing the things we want it to do in the areas we want it to, and the body adjusts the circulatory system, then tolerates it much better.
Gotcha. So let me ask you, they beat us over the head with electrolyte, how be careful to be because of dysrhythmias and such like that. Let's say, obviously, this should not be happening, But for whatever reason, it's dripping in a lot faster than we intended it to. And we give 2 grams in a relatively short amount of time, 5 minutes or whatnot. Is that enough to really start seeing EKG changes?
That's a very valid question. It should not be. Okay. It in itself, that in isolation,
yeah, a relative
should
otherwise
be producing,
person,
yes. Right. The that in itself should not necessarily be producing EKG changes. It is possible, anything's possible, that we aggravate something else on account of that, and then we see some changes. But it's pretty unlikely that 2 grams of magnesium is what has then caused this arrhythmia.
I see.
Also, because, yes, electrolyte balance is important. Magnesium is kind of the playground monitor of electrolytes in cardiac functioning. The magnesium kind of keeps everybody playing nicely. So it in itself, where we have sodium, potassium, and calcium that have specific movement back and forth roles in heart functioning that will readily disrupt that rhythm, magnesium's kind of the, like I said, that overall regulator keeping things in line. So it becomes less temperamental to higher or lower levels of magnesium compared to potassium. Potassium goes high or low, very readily we get changes and concerns. Not
calcium,
so much
but
the calcium.
Gotcha.
We can tolerate those higher lower ranges better in cardiac function than some of the other electrolytes.
Okay, so magnesium is more of the safety or the monitor. It may not be needed or whatnot, or you know what I'm talking
about. It's there. It's doing its job. The body does a real good job when we put a lot of it in that is not going to cause the disruptions that an excess of the other electrolytes will do.
Copy that.
So, in a relatively healthy person, kidneys are good. I mean, we're just going to regulate those electrolytes with water balances, and there we go.
Speaking of which, let's say we do have somebody who, one of those poor people who just got, better question, what's not wrong with this person kind of thing? Those unfortunate folks, you mentioned kidney function. Obviously, kidneys will be the ones responsible for balancing the electrolytes. They're on dialysis. Do we need to be concerned with giving magnesium in that case?
In this circumstance, I would say no.
Okay.
Right. That we may need to, that may accelerate their timeline needing to be dialyzed. But the alternative of not accelerating that timeline is
they don't
take
it
because they don't breathe.
Right.
So we've really eliminated the need for dialysis ultimately, or we just say you might need some dialysis
a little bit
earlier. But again, that magnesium is very well tolerated.
Okay. Yeah. No, we're not going crazy with it.
No. And in really our presentation of giving it too quickly, that's what we're going to see is this patient's going to start to feel itchy, uncomfortable, and start squirming around that I don't like what this is. And a really good response to that is like, stop it.
Okay.
Stop what we're doing. And
they say, hey, I feel itchy. We're blocking it.
I'm feeling mildly itchy, let's make sure to slow it down. Somebody's like, I feel really uncomfortable. Just turn that off. Let's stop. This is a poor response to this medication and making this person anxious and uncomfortable and breathing faster and accelerating their heart rate more is not beneficial.
They'll need more anxiety.
These are the things that we're trying to undo. We get halfway through a magnesium administration and we have this poor response. Just stop. Any therapy. We get halfway through a therapy and we're getting a poor patient response like that. Let's just stop.
Right. That's not how we're going to get 5 out of 5 for
you. This is correct. But right. Think about that what we're trying to accomplish, and it's making the patient better. The goal isn't give all the medications we can. It's make them better.
Right.
So at some point, we may need to come off of that course, and it refers to another phenomenal podcast that you hear the same kind of thing of don't follow through on a failing course, sticking on a sinking ship, I believe was the expression. Don't stay on the sinking ship just for the sake of staying on the sinking ship. Like, get to your endpoint.
Gotcha.
Yeah. All right. We talked about these good stuff with medications. We talked about magnesium. There is some literature that we're going to put in the show notes. We'll link it to that talks about how magnesium is equivalent to an additional dose of albuterol. So rather than just continue to pile stimulant on stimulant on stimulant on stimulant with the albuterol, which is a standard, is kind of a practice. That's a thing. We just keep going with albuterol. We can put some magnesium into the care plan, and that's that. Not everybody needs magnesium, though, right? So just because we have an asthma attack, we give them albuterol Atrovent. Our pretty standard package is going to be those first four: albuterol, Atrovent, tributyline, dexamethasone. And then magnesium kind of becomes a decision point.
Okay.
Right? What do you think of that, Sean? Like, what then takes you from the initial package of four into, I think we need magnesium?
So, personally, we've given that, and we're not giving these medications for no reason. We are anticipating and expecting a response, a desired response. These are not nobody medications. Mm-hmm. They pack a punch and they should start working relatively fast. And if we're not seeing that in that 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, that's when we are thinking about some other additional guns to bring to the fight for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And with this also, we're talking about repeat albuterol being treatment in here. And it is listed that IM epi is an option in there. Because like you said, IV access may be a challenge. And we're going to give this magnesium IV, and it just may not be the option. It may be a great option therapeutically, right, but may not be a practical option for us. So it is, symptoms that aren't resolved, we should be talking about magnesium. And the difference of that is that symptoms have gotten a little bit better, but not where we want them.
Right.
That's still effective therapy. If we do the initial package and things get a little bit better, the initial package was effective. So we can repeat some of that. I could put another albuterol in there and continue to kind of... We've had those ones that you can hardly hear anything in the lungs.
Right.
We get them loaded up with this first medication package, and now we can hear the wheezing because they've actually dilated a little bit. Mm-hmm. Throw another albuterol on there. The first albuterol was effective. We throw another albuterol on. This is right. This is where N-Tidal becomes a crucial component of this. I love N-Tidal. If you haven't picked up that I love N-Tidal, you haven't paid attention to a dang thing. We get this presentation of a flattened out side of... I hate shark fin. We get this flattened out side
of... Albatross fin, would that be better? Or?
Oh, good God, Sean. Right? We get this presentation of bronchoconstriction on N-Tidal, and it should change with albuterol. Okay. It should change with terbutaline. And when it doesn't, then we need to start wondering, are we ineffective in our therapy? Again, are we staying on the sinking ship just because?
Right.
Or not? A lot of things will be fixed with this first four, and we don't need magnesium. I think in my time, I think I've used magnesium about 3 or 4 times. Not a lot. I've used albuterol an awful lot more than 3 or 4 times.
Right.
And magnesium, I'm sitting here on one hand counting it. So you're right. It packs a punch. It's more guns to the fight, but we may not always need it.
Gotcha. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, and the reason terbutaline is a smooth muscle relaxer, mm-hmm. so is magnesium. So it does beg the question, why not give us, this has one single dose of, 0.25 of terbutaline, why not a second dose if we're not seeing the desired effects? Mm-hmm.
The best understanding that I think I can give you is terbutaline is kind of the extra use in respiratory that we know it's a very well-established practice in obstetrics. Mm-hmm. I believe it still is. And the airway respiratory component is not as broadly and generally accepted. So we take it a little bit more conservatively.
Okay.
That we kind of hold on to, right? We keep that one kind of close. And that's why we keep epi in there as a practice that long track record of epi in respiratory emergencies. We right. We know what to anticipate. We know how it's going to go, that we don't have as much confidence, I guess, as an industry in terbutaline. Maybe that isn't the best word. That confidence isn't the best thing. The best track record of it is not such a widely accepted thing.
I get you.
So, yeah, it keeps us a little bit more conservative on the administration of it.
I get you. And I guess thinking about it, we're giving the magnesium so slowly, it's very easy to stop. I guess its effects should be a little bit slower in its onset. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yes. We should, you're right, just with the administration rate of it, we should expect a little bit slower onset. Magnesium in itself, the flow rate may be a little bit slower, but it does have some pretty good response. The body responds pretty quickly to it, and it ends up being pretty effective.
Cool.
Let's see. What else do we got? We talked about early on therapy. We talked about the steroids getting in there. Oh, man. We talked about a whole lot of stuff. I think it's I get really excited about these time frames, this time to intervention, and these things that we can do things. I think we're seeing that in general. I feel like I have that conversation a good number of times that we're doing the right things. Mm-hmm. Let's just start doing them earlier. Let's get this medication in earlier. Let's get this assessment in earlier. Let's cut these time frames down, because ultimately what we're going for is that time to intervention. And you're going to hear it a lot with time to intervention. It's not time to the hospital. It's not scene time has to be under this. It's what's the time to the intervention? What's the time to 12 lead? What's the time to beta agonist? All of these things, the time to our actual intervention of doing something worth substance, something of substance, is what we're measuring, what we're going for. And I think especially in the respiratory, if you get behind, we're already behind.
Right.
You get too far behind, you're not catching up.
Right, then we got a different problem.
Then we're talking about something totally different. And just a fun little bit of teaser in here. If we need to get to a medicated assisted airway in an asthma situation and we need to take over this airway, and further down the road we start talking about paralytics and everything else, ketamine becomes our induction agent of choice. Ketamine in respiratory is especially beneficial. Any guesses on why?
As I understand, nebulized ketamine, that we're getting that.
And we're talking about like IV. We need to put this person to sleep and take their airway.
Oh. As I understand, it's not going to drop their blood pressure.
That's true.
That's not what you're getting at.
It makes it special for airway. I mean, it does great. It's going to dissociate this person, right? It's going to facilitate our procedure.
It's the best pain medication I've ever seen, that's for sure. So we need to knock this person out, and ketamine as opposed to, say, fentanyl. We want to not...
With anything. Fentanyl, etomidate, benzos.
Gotcha. So you think quite highly of this.
I'm a big fan of ketamine.
Okay.
Ketamine in a respiratory airway procedure brings an extra special little benefit.
Gotcha.
Because ketamine has bronchodilatory properties to it.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that awesome? There you go, guys. As we're dealing with concerns about bronchoconstriction, ketamine's got bronchodilatory properties to it. So it makes it a phenomenal, it's going to be our induction agent of choice, period. But it gives us some extra benefit if we are that far down this road that, holy cow, this person has now worn themselves out. They're exhausted. We're no longer trying to make their breathing better. We're kind of taking over their breathing.
Gotcha.
We get an additional benefit out of ketamine being our administered induction agent in that.
That's so cool.
Right? Fun little thing to take with you that will continue to be our induction agent of choice, just because ketamine's fabulous and so versatile and gets the job done. And we'll dive into more of that. We do more of the airway development and airway training.
Cool.
So, Sean, do you have any closing thoughts on any of the stuff we talked about, stuff we didn't get to mention that you were hoping to say today, like that?
I think we talked extensively about all these things, and a lot of these are some of the questions that I've had. You know, one of the scariest things about being a paramedic is, you know, we would all love to have an extensive, detailed experience, knowledge on all these drugs that we would hope that, you know, in our ride outs and things like that, that we would have come across situations where we get to use every single tool in the kit, and I know it, I've seen it. But the truth is a lot of times the first time I'm actually giving that medication ever is I'm alone in the box, and it's like, okay, well, they certainly meet the criteria. I am justified in this. Mm-hmm. But you don't get, you know, you don't have somebody on the phone or whatever. You're like, okay, here we go. And it's nice to have like, hey, here's what happens if you give it too fast, or we give this instead of that. And anything to sort of understand the problem at a deeper level just makes it better for us. We can, you know, administer and help these people with confidence. And, you know, at any time we show up on scene, we want to explain in our actions why they are paying our salaries. Right? We're gonna go, and that's why I pay high taxes here in Sugarland. You know what I mean? Like, we are going to bring the thunder. Your problem will be attacked aggressively, and we are going to help you. That's all there is to it.
We're
going to
bring emergency department level medicine to your emergency wherever it's happening.
That's right.
That's what we're going to do. Let's wrap this up, right? Let's do a quick little summary. Just keep in mind that asthma is an immunological response.
Yes, sir.
That's where dexamethasone becomes a crucial component of the therapy package. It's what addresses the immune system and kind of suppresses that response that is continuing to produce symptoms. but those symptoms will persist if we don't address the symptoms. That's why this is a big care package that Dex alone doesn't fix an asthma attack. Albuterol, Atrovent alone, or even terbutaline alone doesn't fix the asthma attack. That there's a reason this is all bundled together, and it may be listed as medications in the guidelines. I want you to realize that we're talking about a care package. Let's get the nebulized medications going. Let's get the terbutaline and the Dex going all together. That there really should be rare occasions that we don't move through those whole four medications. There may be some of them that slight irritation that a nebulizer really seems like the therapy and it's effective, and we don't need terbutaline, we don't need Dex. You know, it's going to be patient dependent, but I want you to just look at that as a whole package. This is not, let's give a nebulizer, see if it works. Then let's give terbutaline, see if it works. Then let's give Dex and see if it works. No, if we're going to need these things, let's go.
Right.
Go, give it to them, and let's move through. And magnesium then becomes the next level consideration.
Okay. Right?
So that becomes based on our patient condition. You look at this patient, you've given them this care package, 5 minutes has gone by, and you have a deteriorating condition. That's a good consideration for magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, Sean, I really appreciate you taking the time to come have these discussions and talk about how we're managing asthma, reactive airway disease, and even venture a little bit into anaphylaxis and compare some of these similarities to it.
Excellent. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. So thanks for listening, guys. Glad you're here, and we will catch you for the next one.